Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Okay, all right, here we go. It's Wednesday. Wednesdays are hard. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Oh, my God, there are so many of you. Lurking conservatives, how are you doing? Mark Riley, my God.
Where?
How you doing, Riley?
I'm doing all right.
I don't know what the hell is wrong with me. Wednesdays are rough for some reason this morning. I didn't even take a melatonin last night to knock myself out. I went out like a light, and this morning could not get up. Could not get up.
Really?
Yeah, it took 14 alarm clocks to wake me up this morning. Thank God I have that many.
Well, you know, the only reason why I woke up, I thought it was Thursday. I ran a day ahead of myself.
Oh, so you're actually in tomorrow. How's tomorrow
No, no, no. I kind of pawned back into today pretty quickly, but I woke up this morning. Oh, man, it's Thursday. Only one.
What does the future hold, Mark Riley? Mark Riley's in Thursday.
Well, hey, perhaps another indictment in Washington somewhere?
Yeah, that certainly, but I know why you thought it was Thursday. So you would already be done with the dentist.
Yeah,
that's what's going on. You got to go get the deep cleaning today, and you're full of dread and fear.
Yes, I am full of dread and fear. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
I knew it.
You know, and the dentists, they don't really, you know, they try to, with varying degrees of success, they try to let you know that, you know, everything's okay, it's not going to hurt, it's not going to hurt. And then they pull out, you know, a needle the size of a horse needle or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And they stick it in your mouth, and the next thing you know, it's Thursday.
Yeah, it's like, don't worry, this isn't going to hurt. Oh, what the hell is that? What kind of dentist are you? So we are going to be at Florent on Friday. That's in New York's Meatpacking District. Restaurant Florent. We've been there before. Had a great show. They're great coffee. Remember that?
Yeah.
That coffee, they make it French style with the something in it. Chicory, maybe? I don't know.
It was chicory. I had some great French toast there after, too. You ate breakfast there.
Yeah, it was good. Oh, that's right. That's when everyone's like, Mark Riley eats smoked salmon with his French toast. What the hell is that? Mr. Picky does this weird thing with salmon and French toast.
What? It ain't bacon, is it?
No, it's not bacon.
I rest my case.
See, I know. So you're putting it in the category of breakfast meat.
There you go.
Okay, I got it. Which it is, even in the Jewish version. What did you just say to me, Dan?
Well, it wasn't even so much that he put on salmon and French toast. It was the syrup on top of the salmon.
Uh-huh.
Well, that was accidental. That's I didn't do that on purpose.
No, you actually marinated the salmon in the syrup,
wow.
I believe, and then put
No,
top
that was
the French toast.
And then the French toast leaked over. Well, and it all goes to the same place, don't it?
I guess so.
I rest my case.
For a second there, it sounded like Pashman had a case of the Daves. He got in some sort of brain lock there. All right, but I'm sorry, Dave. We're going to talk to you a minute about politics. So start putting something together about. I want to talk about with Little Goliath. I want to talk about delay and what's going on with that. And I want to talk about the plane investigation. I want to talk about that in a few minutes. So try and put a couple sentences together about that, will you, Dave?
We also might want him to break down some of the inner workings of the stock scandal surrounding Bill Frist, because I know Goliath is there. He's getting ready. He's getting ready right now.
Man.
All right.
You're going to have the cops sitting out in front of waiting for this guy one day.
So we'll be at Restaurant Florent. No, and you know what? He's not even like that. He's naturally like that. It's a gift.
I know.
He has the gift of Zen stoneness without even being stoned. It's the fall. I tell you, I swear to God, I wake up in the morning in the fall, and that timeless part of my brain, Riley, just goes back to college, goes back to not caring about the future. Just, you know, all you care about is, you know, whether or not you're going to run into that girl later. It's unbelievable. It's just beautiful. The fall just breaks. It just breaks my heart in a good way. I was listening to hippie music on the way over here. For some reason, the fall is all about Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead and the Band to me. And I don't know what that's about, but there's just some sort of time traveling going on in my head. I get all nostalgic and melancholy in the fall. I'm looking forward to going up to Vermont next month. So we'll have, here's what we're going to have at Florent on Friday. We're going to have mayoral candidate Fernando Ferrer is going to drop by early. So if you want to come by and ask him a question or two or hear what he has to say, he'll be there in the first hour, which is pretty early. So if you're a regular and you want to come down early to see Freddie, come on down for that. We got a bunch of other guests coming. As always, you can email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com. So I guess we should get into this now, Riley. First of all, let's start. Where do you want to start? Let's start with the plane gate situation. In two appearances before the federal grand jury investigating the leak of covert CIA operatives' name, who leaked Valerie Plame's name. Scooter Libby, the chief of staff to Vice President Cheney, it has been revealed that he did not disclose a crucial conversation that he had had with New York Times reporter Judith Miller in June 2003 about Valerie Plame. And now what's happening now is Judith Miller is going back again. She was just there the other day.
After
they found this notebook. Now she's going back because what does this mean, Riley, when you get somebody like Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, who is now not perjured himself, but certainly covered up certain elements and not spoken. What is the word for not saying something pertinent to a grand jury investigator?
It could be indictment. It could end up being an indictment if they believe he deliberately lied or deliberately hid certain information. And that's going to be a very difficult thing, I think, for the grand jury to wrestle with. But Judith Miller's return now for the third time. Once, when she got out of jail, she testified before this grand jury on September 30th. Then again yesterday, and she's agreed to come back today. They are looking, I have to figure, Fitzgerald is looking very deeply at the conversations between her and Libby, exactly how that notebook wound up in the New York Times Washington Bureau 2 years after the fact, and whether or not Libby deliberately misled the grand jury about his contact with Judith Miller, and this is the payoff, whether or not this is part and parcel of a pattern on the part of the administration to kind of cover up the fact that they were dropping Valerie Plame's name. They were trying to undercut and marginalize Joe Wilson even before the article that he wrote on July 6, 2003.
Okay, so that's where we're at. What's going on now is that these conversations between Scooter Libby and Judith Miller reveal that there was some discussion, not only just about, I think what you're saying is that, if I understand properly, is that they were clearly planning, what this indicates is that they were clearly planning some sort of release of this information to the press, okay? Right?
Well, what you're talking about here is conversations that took place in late June,
right,
2003.
So that means the two things that are going on is that what he's trying to prove, what the grand jury and prosecutor Fitzgerald is trying to prove, it seems, is that not only was there a plan in place to reveal her name to the press, all right, but there was a plan in place to cover up that revelation because they knew they had screwed up somehow. And now what we're seeing is that the Wall Street Journal reports today that there are signs that Fitzgerald is exploring whether there is an effort within the administration at an early stage to develop and disseminate confidential information the press, which is what we just said, and this is why what is unfolding now is that there are ruminations that the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg are both working on stories that point to Dick Cheney as the target of Fitzgerald's investigations.
Now that would be very interesting because Dick Cheney has made himself so scarce that none other than Michael Wolff has written an article about how scared. Now show you how this works, Mark.
Yeah.
Michael Wolff says in this article that a spokesperson for Dick Cheney refused to provide any information about Dick Cheney's schedule on the condition that that Michael Wolff agreed not to say that she refused to provide the information. Now, I can't even wrap my brain around that.
Wow. I don't want to get so complicated here that I don't understand. We both, this thing has been going on. Riley and I have been going over this stuff for months, and it just keeps getting bigger and smaller. But the bottom line is, within a couple of weeks, we're going to know the lowdown. We're going to know who's indicted. We're going to know what the charges are. I mean, there's talk that some journalists actually might be indicted. It's clear to me that some within the administration are going to be indicted. I mean, this conspiracy would most likely involve what they used to call the White House Iraq Group, which was created in August 2002 to set a strategy for selling the war in Iraq to the public. Rove and Libby were part of that group. There's some indications that there might be some infighting within the inner sanctum of the White House between Andrew Card, his minions, and Karl Rove and what he represents in there. We've got something that was said by Howard Fineman on NBC last night. He's the chief political correspondent on Hardball with Chris Matthews. We'll play that for you in just a second. And also, it's important to note that on Thursday night, last Thursday at the National Review's 50th anniversary party, one of the speakers didn't show up, and that guy who didn't show up for that gig was Dick Cheney.
He was busy.
He was busy doing what? I don't know. He cites health reasons, but he wanted to go on at 7. Then he said he wanted to go on at 7:30. Then he wanted to go on 7. He said they were health reasons. I mean, what's a half hour unless they hooked him up to the charger a little little late. I don't know. But then he doesn't show up at all. Now, this obviously reveals there, I think, and we've speculated about this before, he's either in cold storage or he's freaking out. He's either dead or he's freaking out. I do want to play you that sound that that reveals some speculation on behalf of Howard Fineman from NBC, the chief political correspondent over there, about the nature of what is going on within the inner sanctum of the White House. So stay tuned for that. It's 16 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning's Edition.
Morning's Edition.
Just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Bush family, political family, is at war with itself inside the White House. My sense is it's Andy Card, the chief of staff, and his people against Karl Rove, the brain.
Right.
And that runs through a whole lot of things, whether it's Harriet Myers or Katrina, but it all starts with Iraq and some submerged but now emerging divisions within the administration over why we went into that war, how we went into that war, and what was done to sell it. There are people out for Karl Rove inside that White House, which makes his situation even more perilous.
Wow, that was Howard Fineman. It is 21 past the hour. That was Howard Fineman from NBC, chief political correspondent over there. That was on MSNBC's Hardball with Chris Matthews last night. More encouraging news that the administration is eating its own and fragmenting from within. Whether Rove will be indicted, who knows? Whether Skibby Looter, who is the alter ego of Scooter Libby, who was the chief of staff of Vice President Dick Cheney. Whether he'll go down, Cheney will go down, Ari Fleischer, you know, Judith Miller, who the hell knows what's going to happen. But what you said on the break was interesting, Riley. You're hoping that the little dogs go, you know, get hit first with indictments. Why?
Well, because Patrick Fitzgerald is a federal prosecutor, unlike Ronnie Earl down in Texas, and we'll get into that a little bit later.
Yeah.
Fitzgerald is a federal prosecutor, and the feds are real good at flipping people by, you know, offering, you know, telling them they're going to do some hard, long time if they don't talk.
Why don't they just rendition them? Can't they just rendition them to Pakistan?
No, no.
Give them a taste of their own medicine.
With people like this, long prison sentences are usually more than it. These guys have never envisioned themselves going to jail.
Yeah, they're wussies, and none of them have ever fought anything.
You know, a deputy assistant, secretary, or whatever, they're not thinking about jail, but they ought to think about some of the guys that have gone on before them in some of these corporate scandals, because they weren't thinking about jail either.
I just think it's great.
And federal prosecutors like Fitzgerald have been known to flip on these guys. And it is obvious, A, that the administration can't do anything about Patrick Fitzgerald, and B, that he's fearless. He doesn't care who he indicts in.
And it's weird because, you know, what Fineman was saying in that bit of a sound we just heard, it's interesting because you haven't been hearing a lot about Andy Card during this investigation. You have to assume that, you know, he has definitely testified, but you're not hearing the stink sitting on him yet.
So not yet.
Who the hell knows what's going to happen with this? I'll tell you, I'll be very disappointed, as will Dan Pashman and John Crimmings, Boy Genius from Wisconsin. You know, we will all be very disappointed if this crap doesn't hit the fan in a major way. Even Kayla, who doesn't care about this stuff, is going to be disappointed if it doesn't go down.
True.
Am I right?
See?
All right. So let's get back into some more failings and scandals here. Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, is in deep poop, my friends. Turns out documents show that Frist earned tens of thousands of dollars from stock in HCA, the family-founded hospital chain. The stocks were largely controlled by his brother, and the stocks were outside the blind trust he created to avoid a conflict of interest. All right. Remember, he's been saying that he could own HCA stocks and still vote on health care legislations without a conflict because he had placed the stocks in blind trust, which is this silly idea where it's like, I have the money, but I don't know how much money I have because I'm not allowed to know. Well, now it's being revealed that apparently this partnership arrangement that HCA had with his brother, who oversaw the company and the money in the company, some ethics experts say a partnership arrangement of that nature raises serious doubts about whether the senator truly avoided the conflict that he was talking about.
Well, now they're saying that the money that he invested on the side here was invested in a Tennessee blind trust as opposed to a government-qualified blind trust. And apparently his brother, Thomas Frist, was his seeing eye dog for this blind trust because they could influence decisions. They did know exactly what was going on with the company at the time.
His brother.
His brother.
Yeah, so what's he going to say now? Yeah, we don't talk much. You know, we don't talk much. I just let him do his thing. I do my thing. Occasionally talk, but never about money. He's toast. I can't wait. I hope so. Now, what can happen with him, Riley, if the SEC finds him guilty? Does he get indicted, too? Can he do time on this thing, or does he just get kicked out?
No, my guess is he wouldn't do any time. The scandal, the taint, would certainly cause him to lose his gig as Senate Majority Leader, and he might have to make some, you know, very serious adjustments to how he deals with HTA's money. At this point, I can't imagine he'd still have any stock left, but even if he does... And I guess maybe he does in these blind trusts. I would get rid of all of it. He'd have to get rid of all of it.
Oh, the hell with him. The stink is on him. The stink is on all of them. Tom DeLay is guilty, obviously, as far as I'm concerned. And he's made some desperate moves lately that we're gonna talk about in a minute. We've got just a big pot full of scandal here, and it's very exciting because we've got a whole show to talk about it. But I want to take a little, just a minute to set up our guests that are going to be coming up here in just a moment. I saw a movie last night, and I'll tell you, folks, it was quite a profound experience. This is a movie that Joseph Castillo is the director, and Iyad Akhtar, the lead actor in this film, The War Within. They're going to be in here in a minute. And this is really about, it's a very, actually humane, I don't know if it's humane, but it puts a human face on the many different aspects of what it is to be a Muslim, from the American Muslim to the radical Muslim to the actual, what we've grown to know as terrorists. And it's something like I've never seen before, and it was a moving and profound movie. The movie itself, cinematically, is not, spectacular, but the narrative and the story and the characters in dealing with the Muslim experience in the world that we live in today, in all its harshness, the full spectrum of what it is to be a Muslim, was incredible. I mean, you know, we talk about this stuff every day, Riley. We talk about Iraq. We talk about terrorism, terrorist threats. And you never, you know, it's always in the abstract because I don't know or sit down and talk to many American Muslims. I don't.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't think most Americans understand, particularly in the immediate wake of 9/11, what it was like to be a Muslim in this country.
Well, you know, and this movie really explores that, and I thought it was tremendous. Also, the terror threats that have been proven, or not proven,
not
have
proven.
Been, it's said that they're a hoax, but Bloomberg is still defending his actions. And you know what? I understand what Bloomberg's saying because I kind of defend his actions. It's 27 past the hour. We'll get into that later. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Hey, you guys, we got Studs Terkel later in the show, which is I'm looking forward to that, Riley. How about that,
Studs Terkel?
How amazing is that going to be? And also, I think Future Mark's going to call in. But right now, our next guests have just released a film that breaks new ground in its depiction of the impact of the U.S. war on terror and the schism between fundamentalists and secular Muslims. The film is called The War Within, and we're joined now by the film's director, Joseph Castillo. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, and the lead actor, Iyad Akhtar. Is that right? Oh wait, we're not getting a mic read on this. Can we? I don't want him to feel like he has no voice here. This is very important.
No, as a matter of fact, it's completely disconnected.
Are you there? Oh, it's not even plugged in. Come on, is this on? Is this on now, Dan? I think it is. Talking there.
No.
Oh,
no, it's completely disconnected.
All right. Well, look. Here's what we're going to do. I just want to say first and foremost that. The movie, I found the movie to be... Thank God you're here. And you co-wrote part of the... co-wrote the script.
Yeah.
Which is genius, by the way.
Thanks, man.
I want to say that the effect that this film had on me, and I just watched it last night, this is a film that covers a broad spectrum of certainly the Muslim experience in this country right now. And certainly, I have not... As I don't know a lot of Muslims, I live among many Muslims, but I have few friends. But the film did reveal to me in a sympathetic way, you know, all areas, even on the level of the character that is so committed that he becomes, you know, part of a terrorist cell. Now, I can only thank you for revealing this part of the Muslim experience for me. And also, I need to ask both of you, what has the reaction to this film been?
You know, it's been strange. I mean, the thing is that audiences really, really, really connect to the movie.
Yeah.
When we go to Q&As, you know, sort of at the end of the film, the entire audience is silent and often crying. And, you know, there's just a kind of openness and a kind of willingness to have dialogue. That said, critics, you know, have had a difficult time coming to any kind of a meaningful consensus about the film's strengths, its weaknesses, its purpose. Everybody seems to throw in their opinion about the war on terror. It's almost as if the film becomes a platform for people to begin talking about
a discussion.
What they think the film should have done.
Yeah, and also I think that's probably a good effect. What I found, what I said to you on the break when you first came in here, fellas, is that, you know, I these are new characters to America. These are well-rounded, you know, Muslim characters that are all in some kind of deep conflict one way or the other. I mean, the main character, the protagonist, which you play brilliantly to the point where I was frightened when you came in. I wanted to, you know, check the coat.
I'm just a cheesehead from Wisconsin.
Oh, come on, really? Isn't it weird how we judge? It's so weird how we judge. But the one thing what was I saying, is in the character at the beginning of the film gets renditioned, which we talk a lot about. Right. On this program, but you know, to put a human face on that act where this guy who is, I'm assuming, a secular Muslim gets picked up on the street in Paris by American CIA operatives, taken to Pakistan and tortured, which leads to his conversion into radical Islam and his being part of a terror cell here in New York was mind blowing. and I guess I'm talking too much. Joe, why don't you tell me what brought you to this project?
Well, like everyone else in New York who suffered through 9/11, you know, I felt like I should turn my attention towards why something like that could happen, how it could possibly happen. And we felt like as filmmakers that there wasn't anything else that we should be working on, frankly.
Yeah.
And at the time we had talked about, you know, why aren't filmmakers paying more attention to the subject matter? Why aren't artists turning themselves in this direction? And documentarians certainly led the way. But you know, we felt this is the kind of subject matter that we should be grappling with.
Now, you knew, Joe Costello, going in that a film that dealt, I guess, from such a basis, I guess, of reality, would maybe have its art or you know, the typical criteria that people use to judge film suspended because people were going to talk about the substance of the content itself, right? I mean, you knew that they were going to say, well, this is really about the war on terror. This is, you know, I feel this way, I feel that way. And maybe they weren't going to judge the film on its artistic merits.
Well, I mean, that's been happening. I mean, you know, people talk about the film. They say that this is a 9/11 film. And it's important to make the distinction that it's a post-9/11 film.
Mm-hmm.
The world has changed so much since 9/11.
Oh, yeah, deal a lot with the element of suspicion. That is like running through the entire film. That is what becomes the ominous point at the end of this movie, is that it almost reads, you know, sadly the only comparison I can make in my head is that at the end of the movie, you know, like those films, the after school films about alcoholism and how one person, one alcoholic in a family can have the repercussions
right.
that ruin the whole family. Mm-hmm. This is sort of like, you know, one terrorist in the family can really ruin the whole family because of the implications in culture of suspicion, of distrust, of generalization, that the one, you know, outside of the many victims that reveal themselves in this movie, the innocent guy really gets screwed at the end.
Well, moderates on all, I mean, moderates in general, the ones who are suffering.
Yes, and that's something you never see, because all anyone says is, like, moderates aren't talking.
Right, right.
And I don't know why that is, but they certainly have a voice in this film. And now, are you a Muslim yourself?
I've come from a secular Muslim family, you know.
See, a lot of people don't even think you guys exist.
Sure. You know, we're like the Christians who go to the proverbial sort of Christmas Eve Mass and the Easter morning Mass, and that's about it. You know?
Do you hear that, people? They exist. There are secular Muslims.
There are so many.
We're just out there in the world, you know, enjoying America.
Yeah, and enjoying their own relation to Islam as well.
Okay, so why don't we talk about that a little bit? What, like, right. As a personal, from your personal point of view, because I know the character that you play is a fanatical Muslim to the most extreme.
Right.
But how do, because I'm a Jew and I'm a secular Jew, and I kind of make fun of the fact that I'm a Jew and that I don't practice that much. Is it the same with you and your experience?
You know, I mean, there's a limited number of people you can really joke about that with, because for the most part, you know, living in this culture, you're not necessarily in contact with all that many Muslims.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, when you and I talk about you being a cultural Jew, I've got so many, I went to college, all my friends were Jewish. Uh-huh. So in a way, I totally understand, you know, I mean, I understand the references.
Yeah.
But, you know, as a Muslim, there's, you know, the references, there are just as many references, nobody else gets them.
That's because they're not culturally ingrained.
Exactly.
And now that the possibility of that happening has become limited by fear.
Now, Ayad Akhtar, how deep did you have to dig to become this character? It's a very controversial character, Hassan. Yeah. How did you prepare for it?
Well, you know, we got our hands on everything we could. We read, you know, all kinds of stuff. We talked to all kinds of people. You know, we didn't actually talk to any terrorists. But, you know, you just kind of accumulate as much information as you can, and then you try to put it together in some meaningful way with experiences you've had yourself, and you put these inside pieces together with the outside pieces, and you kind of create an emotional logic over time. And, you know, you just hope that you're doing a good job. I had a lot of good guidance from Joe. And, you know, it was a really collaborative effort. And I had 8 months to prepare the role. And I was also one of the writers. So, you know, I kind of had an inside understanding of what was required of me.
But was it emotionally taxing for you as an actor?
It was brutal. It was brutal because I'm a kind of an immersion type actor. So I have to become the role. And in a lot of ways, what I was working with was a man who's really, really been scarred and who is.
Literally.
Yeah, true. And who's also, you know, suffering with a degree of depression, and by that I also mean social depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of a portrayal of a suicide. You know, as a writer, as a filmmaker, obviously always I had to keep in mind that it was a murder. It was an act of murder. But as an actor, from the inside, it felt like an act of suicide.
Yeah, I don't want to tip too much about the film because I really want people to go see it because it is such a tight script. And again, the fascination that I had with it was that you've got yourself who, you know, the character was a secular Muslim, just, you know, finishing up college, I guess, in Paris or graduate school.
Right.
And gets sucked into this world of torture because his brother was involved in something.
Right.
Which is not clear. And then the guy that you meet in prison is basically, I'm assuming, a prison convert to radical Islam, converts you, and then you rehook up with this guy in the States in a terror cell situation. And he ends up being, you know, I guess that's loosely based on some of the 9/11 bombers who were depicted as, you know, boozing it up, going to strip clubs and whatnot.
That was something that we took from our research. A lot of these guys were, you know, hanging out in strip clubs the night before their mission, bragging about what they were going to do.
Right, and this guy in the film ends up not being able to pull it off.
Right, and each character in the film has their own interpretation of jihad.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular character's interpretation is very different from Hassan's.
Yeah.
And we wanted to, you know, demonstrate that and show that this is a very self-interpretive act for each of these, you know, terrorists.
Yeah, and the fascinating thing was that you, the other character in the film, the actor, he plays your childhood friend, who is the Saeed, who is the secular Muslim.
Played by a guy named Firdaus Bamji.
Great. He was great. And the woman I've seen in, what was she in? Mississippi
Sarita
Marsala?
Sarita Chaudhry, Mississippi Marsala.
Yeah, she was great too. But the idea that you're kind of in the country, they don't know what you're here for. You say you're looking for a job, you're kind of staying at their house, and eventually you're making bombs in the basement.
Yeah.
How do Muslims who've seen the film, how do they react? Have you talked to them in Q&A's?
Yeah, you know, I think they're very moved because the film, as Mark was saying earlier, the other Mark, you know, the film really does begin to paint a portrait that hasn't been painted yet within American movies, which is, you know, this sort of broad array of practices and beliefs amongst the Muslim-American experience. And I think they're very grateful for that and very moved by it. And I think that they're also moved by the way in which the film is really gets behind moderates and really takes up their cause and says, you know, these are the people who are suffering because of this.
Why do you think it is that so few people really understand that there are a large pool of moderates that practice Islam?
Well, you know, I'd like to add that we screened the film for the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee.
Oh, okay.
In Washington,
sure.
And they endorsed the film.
Oh, great.
And
strongly.
And it was interesting because their main question was, you know, how do you guys feel about representing this stereotype again in the media? And you know, I thought that was a really important question. But we feel like that stereotype is titanium clad, and it's used for entertainment value. In a very irresponsible way.
And has been for years. That's the only depiction that we've seen.
And we felt like, let's get this out. Let's talk about it. Let's do it in a way that empowers moderates.
And let's give dimensionality to a representation that may be familiar, and let's make that representation unfamiliar in some very significant way.
Well, what we talk about a lot on this show, or we have in the past, is the lack of a voice for moderate Muslims in this country. And there's also been complaints culturally and in the press as to why wasn't there more of a reaction. I guess there's a lot of ways to speculate as to why there was not a broader and more consensus voice of moderate Muslims in this country. But I believe that this film certainly brings, you know, that to light.
Well, that's great. Really, I mean, that really is one of the profound intentions that we had in making the film.
But that brings up another question, and that is, does the media undercover, or did they undercover, the moderate Muslim response to September 11th? You know, people said, well, there wasn't any. Was that actually true?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it was. I remember my you know, it's complicated because I think that there's been a long, long history of confusion around this issue, and both amongst Muslims. And I think one of the things that the film tries to do is it really tries to depict the fact that there is a living war within Islam ideologically. And that little boy's soul, in a sense, the next generation.
Oh, the son, your friend's son. What, that stuff was just powerful. Go ahead. Sorry.
That storyline is really about depicting the fact that the next generation's vision of what Islam is really up for grabs.
Yeah.
And so I think that one of the reasons it may have been undercovered, well, this is sort of separate but is related, is that I think a lot of Muslims were terribly afraid after 9/11. Not only were they wounded, but they were afraid, and so they retreated and weren't really going to speak to anybody about anything, because who knows how the words are going to be misconstrued.
Yeah. Well, the film is called The War Within. It has been playing at the Sundance Theater here in New York on Houston Street for a couple of weeks. It opens around the nation this weekend. I highly recommend this movie. It's certainly on a characterological level like nothing you've ever seen before. Our guests have been Joseph Castillo and Ayad Akhtar. I appreciate you guys being here.
It's the Sunshine Theater on
Houston. What did I say?
Sundance.
You see,
that's the new one.
I've been to the Sunshine, and I just read what was written here, and someone's going to pay for that, fellas. I really appreciate you guys being here.
Thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks for the film. It's 48 past the hour. Future Mark is on the line. We'll talk to you in a second.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
All right, folks, it's 52 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
We'll be broadcasting live from Restaurant Florent in New York's Meatpacking District this Friday morning. We'll have New York City Democratic mayoral candidate Fernando Ferrer. If you want to get there early, you can come down and hear what he has to say. Maybe ask him a question or two. We got the comedy. We got everything. That's Restaurant Florent. It's down on Ganzevoort Street in the Meatpacking District this Friday. I'm going to get that right.
Hey, Mark. No, you got it right.
Yeah, all right. What, Chris?
Future Mark is online one.
Cool, I love that guy. Put him on.
Hey buddy, what's up?
So Future Mark, what's going on in 2050?
I'm eating, man. Dinner number 3. Gotta keep my weight up.
Keep your weight up? Oh no. Am I fat in the future?
Oh, you betcha. 300 pounds of heavenly joy right here, buddy.
300 pounds? What happened? Did I just let myself go, or what?
No. There was a biochemical disaster in 2021, and most of Kazakhstan just fell off, dude. It ruined the alignment of the Earth, and now the gravity fluctuates day to day, kind of like the weather. So everyone has to stay really fat just to keep our balance.
Wow.
Hold on, lasagna guy's here. Oh yeah, come to Papa. Whew. I'm exhausted.
So what happens if you're thin?
Well, you just float away. Happens all the time. That's how we lost Future Brendan McDonald. He's still orbiting, dude. Oh. The poor skinny bastard. Sometimes on a clear night, you can see him past the moon. There goes another one. There are public service announcements all the time. Eat more, but do they listen?
Hey, is that an ambulance?
No, it's Domino's truck.
Really?
They're considered emergency vehicles now. Huh. That meat lover's combo could be saving somebody's life, Mark. Hey,
dude, isn't it dangerous to eat so much?
Mmm, not when it's chocolate broccoli. It's this good. Oh, man.
Mm. Oh, man. They put chocolate on broccoli?
No, no, no. It's just chocolate shaped like broccoli. Whoa, sorry, dude. Too many hot Velveeta shots last night. On the plus side, I am huge today. Screw you, light gravity.
Hey, that's disgusting.
Not anymore, my friend. It's energy. That's right. Our super high-fat diet has us producing so much methane that we use it for all our energy needs. No more OPEC holding us hostage, pal. We get all the energy we need about 2 hours after eating a chili cheeseburger. Oh, wow. That's the sound of energy independence, my buddy. My freedom ring. You want to hear the national anthem?
Do I have to?
Just the end. Kind of chokes you up just a little, doesn't it?
Okay, dude, whatever. You got any advice for me in the future?
Eat early, eat often, and keep some mayonnaise in the car for emergency. Gotta go, dine for dessert. There's always room for chicken fried cheesecake with gravy. Later, skinny.
Ah, later. Oh, no. What happened? There's so many things wrong with what just happened. First of all, I was getting uncomfortable talking to me, the idea of being that fat. Second of all, a lot of flatulent funny. Ooh. Which is not something we do a lot here, but it's good every once in a while to get down to basics.
I love that we've now killed Brendan McDonald in the future and the past.
Past year, right?
We had the Brendan. Salem witch trials. Where we lost Brendan McDonald, the elder.
Oh, that's right. Oh, coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to get into the terror threat, the idea that it was a hoax coming from CNN and the New York Post, and Michael Bloomberg standing by his guns in terms of his reaction to it. Riley speculating on some friction within between the federal and state authorities. It's a captivating conversation. We have Studs Terkel also in the next hour. He is 94 years old, and we're looking forward to talking to him because he is one of the great populist documentarians of the American experience.
He's an icon.
That's for sure. I'm very excited to meet him. Also, you know, and this is what I get excited about. This guy is coming up later in the show. Well, obviously, we're going to talk about the scandals, Frist going down, Delay going down, Rove going down, friction and schisms within the GOP. Very exciting stuff. But really, to me, I'm excited to meet Mark Bittman. All right, Mark Bittman's coming up later in the show. He wrote The Best Recipes in the World. More than 1,000 international dishes to cook at home. Dude, this book, I brought it home, and I was going to bring it back in because I'm going to talk to him about it, and I didn't want to bring it back because I was afraid it would get lost. That's how much I love cookbooks. What is there something wrong with that?
No, he spent 6 years traveling the world looking for recipes.
Dude, how exciting is it going to be to talk about food from around the world, Pastor?
Yeah.
Maybe you can tell him how to roast a suckling pig, Jew. All right, we'll be back. Studs Terkel and more, 57 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. It's 6 past the hour, people. Good morning. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. Man, we got a good hour coming up here, Riley. We got Studs Terkel, one of the great heroes of the of populist literature, my friend.
Oh,
This guy is one of the great voices of America. He's 94 years old. I'm glad we're going to have him in studio. I'm glad he's still out in the world doing stuff. He's got a new book coming out. Looking forward to talking to him. We're going to talk a bit about the politicizing terror, the terror threat in New York being called a hoax by some, but Michael Bloomberg standing by and Police Commissioner Ray Kelly standing by their guns in their reaction. Have a little conversation about that. And of course, we're going to take a look at the GOP scandal docket. One thing I'd like to put out there, you know, yesterday I made a comment about this being my last month. I want to tell you people, it is not necessarily my last month. I am just experiencing a little job fear. You know how we get when you work at a place and the terms of your employment are coming up for reevaluation. I'm experiencing a little fear because I've not been told what's going to happen with me. And as we know in this business, people are just disappeared. It's just one day you turn on the radio and it's music again, or it's somebody else talking. That's the way radio works. And I just wanted to prepare you people for that if that may happen. Here we go.
So this could be your last month?
Kind of what I'm saying. Who the hell knows around here? Do you know what I'm saying? You know, I'm like,
so tomorrow could be your last day.
If I keep talking, it might. Where do you want to take me with this conversation? you want to bait me into saying something? Well, that's the horrible thing is, but that's where it stands. And there is no negotiations that are really taking place. It's just a matter of somebody saying yes or no. And that's all. I guess what I'm experiencing is just a little fear. And now I've included all of you in that. So you know what's up. So I don't just disappear without you knowing what's up. There you go. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. First Lady Laura Bush has said that criticism of Supreme Court nominee Harriet Myers may stem from sexism. Laura Bush said, quote, "The president isn't showing any favoritism for Myers just because she happens to be his second wife." Mrs. Bush also said Myers was a role model for young women. So girls, if you want to get ahead, find the drunkest frat boy in the room and then defend every horrible thing he does until he becomes president. Speculation ran rampant as Vice President Dick Cheney was conspicuously absent from a big conservative shindig. Unconfirmed reports indicate Cheney was rolling around in a big pile of money and lost track of time. Other sources say Cheney could not take a chance staying out late, as he cannot, under any circumstances, be out during sunrise. Cheney's spokesman cited medical reasons for Cheney's absence. He apparently came down with a sudden case of accessory to felonyitis. That's accessory to felonyitis. All right. Iraq's election commission said that Saddam Hussein will be allowed to vote in Saturday's election. Saddam reportedly has hired James Baker to count his vote. Wow. That was a little inside, but nothing. I didn't expect to get Kalo or Goliath on that one, but man, I could have. Not Pashman did the delayed laugh? Yeah, he could. All right, man.
With jokes like that, buddy.
Your name again? I appreciate you being here. That's great. I'm glad you're filling in for the guy I like. Anyways, let me repeat the setup. Iraq's election commission said that Saddam Hussein will be allowed to vote in Saturday's election. Stranger still, Saddam is thinking of casting a write-in ballot for Ross Perot. Ross Perot. Hello. All right. Sources close to Saddam say he'll vote for whichever candidate opposes the death penalty. Now that is the best joke on the piece of paper. That is just the best joke on the piece of paper. You know, what do I got to do here? God, maybe I am going to be... All right, here we go. What's going on, man? I'm looking forward to that political commentary, Dave. Little Goliath, can you throw a mic in front of that guy's face? Hey, Little Goliath, how's it coming? Are you working up something on delay in the scandals?
I hope he gets busted. That's all I can say.
I know you don't smoke pot, right?
I mean, I don't smoke pot coming to work, I'll tell you.
You don't need to.
It's 7:10 a.m., so.
Yeah, yeah. Here in New York.
You sound real credible, like Bill Clinton.
So we're going to look into some of that. We're going to talk a little bit more about the plane gate scandal, too, as well, right, in a minute?
All right, yeah. I'll look at. Okay.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places.
Here we go. New information has revealed the terror threats that freaked out New York City over the weekend was a hoax, or more precisely, perhaps a lie. The informant in Iraq that was called a reliable source of information in the past admitted that he was making it all up, perhaps. The city has obviously decreased his terror threat and the security measures that were put into place last week. And this is interesting because what happens when one guy makes something up in the middle of the desert, if he indeed made it up? The entire city of New York is put in freak-out mode. Hundreds of thousands of dollars are spent in cops overtime. Other cities in the United States, like San Francisco, raise their terror alerts. And, of course, the timing is suspect. The day after a speech during which Bush tried to re-frighten America into believing in his failing venture in Iraq, security and fighting terror is the only thing that Bush has to go on, that people are still stupid enough to believe in him about, yet they are unable to make connections on a conspiracy/political level. operation or foreign policy level, babbling. What I'm basically saying is that human beings, people that believe in Bush, cannot make the connections that on a conspiracy level and on a political level, or even a foreign policy level, that he is the one responsible for causing terror, he being Bush. You know, this guy allows this terror alert to get through. How can we be this shoddy in intelligence gathering at this point in time, Riley? I mean, you know, and look at the other stuff that it covered up. You know, Karl Rove going before the grand jury again. You know, and it's also been a while since the administration laid a terror threat pimp slap up the side of the country's head to get it to do what it wants. And I think that most Americans are wary of this. The one thing I do like is that Bloomberg said, quote, I don't know that it was confirmed as a hoax at all, end quote. You know, there's a different discussion, Riley, to be had around whether or not Michael Bloomberg acted properly. I think the discussion we should have now is how the hell at this point in time, you know, this long after 9/11, can, you know, intelligence abroad be this shoddy, and is it still being used? Obviously it is, to politicize terror for, you know, to hide things or frighten people. But I just don't understand how this intelligence breakdown can still be occurring.
Well, it appears as though this was an intelligence breakdown that is still unresolved. According to one published report today, the three people who were arrested inside Iraq were the subject of shoot-to-kill orders by the U.S. military last week before the terror threat in New York was revealed. Now, that doesn't sound like somebody that thinks these people are about the business of hoaxing anybody.
Mm-hmm.
The Bloomberg administration says, look, we got credible information about a credible threat. It was the FBI that stood next to these guys during, you know, as Bloomberg and Kelly announced the ramped up security. And then it's the FBI that starts eroding the credibility of the guy's information in the first place. So I'm not sure exactly who's trying to hang whom out to dry, but somebody in the federal bureaucracy believed this was a credible threat, or they wouldn't have had a shoot to kill order on these people.
Exactly. And I, you know, in terms of Bloomberg and in terms of whatever actions he took, I think that in my gut that on some level, if it is a credible threat, or if somebody decided it was a credible threat despite whatever the intentions of the neocon death cult were, you know, he took some of the right actions. But let's talk about these sources, because this has happened before. The entire Iraq war was based on faulty intelligence that came through a couple of operatives that were on the Bush payroll, basically Ahmed Chalabi and, you know, his brother-in-law the guy Curveball. Remember the guy Curveball?
Yeah.
He was an Iraqi defector, and he was a central source for pre-war intelligence used to sell the war to the American public. This guy Curveball, all right? He was an Iraqi chemical engineer with stories about Iraq's mobile biological laboratories that became the subject of 100 Defense Intelligence Agency reports and the focus of a 2002 National Intelligence Estimate. There were warnings that he was nuts, that he was a waste of time, that he wasn't valid, and not even in Iraq. In Iraq, this guy was a lunatic.
Well, yeah, and they knew that he, you know, had given them bad information in the past, and it turned out some of the information they gave about those mobile weapons facilities turned up in Colin Powell's speech to the UN. So somebody found that guy credible as well. It is, in fact, but see, what they tried to do in that instance was put it all off on George Tenet, who was then CIA director.
Well, this becomes a real question, and the same with Ahmed Chalabi, who was also, you know, on the Bush payroll and, you know, has gone in and out and is obviously still in politics over there, that the people that were supplying the information, either about biological weapons, chemical weapons, or weapons of mass destruction, was it really a question of them being credible, or was it that they were giving the administration the information they needed to take the actions they wanted to take back in 1995? And this becomes a question in terms of how this information was used last week. Was it credible, or did they see it as a way, if they let that through, that something would happen? Because George Bush said, look, you know, Bloomberg can do whatever he wants. We just pass along the information. The states can make their own decision. But by allowing stuff to get by negligence, you know, this complicit negligence, like they're just sort of like, well, we don't know. Yet, obviously, it has implications. And by engaging in that negligence, what happens is that huge actions are taken, and just coincidentally, it obfuscates a number of scandals and refrightens the public.
Well, I think municipalities all over this country ought to be very afraid as far as what happened to New York is concerned here. Because what this means is that this administration will hang any municipality out to dry when it comes to terror information. You saw it happen in terms of New Orleans and how they offloaded all the responsibility for Katrina onto Ray Nagin's head. That's essentially the template they used to dump on Bloomberg here, to say essentially, well, you know, we develop the information, we pass it along, we have nothing to do with how they react to it.
Well, we're going to talk about this in just a minute. We're going to talk a little bit more about scandal, and also we're going to talk about just how this negligence, you know, profits the neocon death cult and Republican cronies at every turn. That, you know, disaster and negligence, you know, equal profit, fear equals votes for these people. It's 17 past the hour. We got Studs Terkel coming up. Stay with us. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it. Eat it.
On Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey,
You know, it's Wednesday, and we're trying to the middle of the week thing, man. I'll tell you, sometimes I just can't pull it together, my friends. We're going to be talking to Studs Terkel in just a few minutes. We're also going to be giving you a little more information on the scandal rundown, the big Republican scandals. There are many. You got Frist, you got DeLay, you got maybe all of them, the entire inner sanctum of the White House going down. A little later in the show, we're going to talk about the implications to the liberal program, to the liberal agenda, to the liberal talking points in terms of post-Katrina response, and how it seems that the media and the Democrats are allowing the Republicans to hijack the frame as to, in terms of how we are reacting to that and selling it out. I'll explain that later. It seems a little complicated, but I'm going to get to it. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. Every time I hear that, I think of Brendan sitting on a beach, not thinking about us. All right, from the Associated Press, study suggests fish is good for brain. Study suggests fish is good for brain. Translation, why don't otters rule the earth? All right, from the Washington Post, records suggest warm ties for Bush and Myers. Records suggest warm ties for Bush, Myers. Translation, Myers blackmailing Bush, knows where everybody is buried.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. From Newsday, DeLay launches media blitz. Translation, DeLay is guilty as hell. That's for sure. Let's get into that. We haven't talked about that at all. Let's talk about old Tom DeLay. Since the first indictment was leveled against Tom DeLay on September 28th, the guy has made over 20 radio and TV appearances proclaiming his innocence and blaming the Democrats for a partisan attack out of hate for what the Republicans have accomplished, which is what exactly? Running the country into a ditch of debt and making it harder for people to live? Ronnie Earle, the Texas state prosecutor, facilitated the grand jury indictments against DeLay, said, quote, they often accuse others of doing what they themselves do, unquote. Ronnie's getting biblical.
Uh-oh.
And DeLay is, laying subpoenas on Ronnie Earle now. In a desperate tactic that shows that DeLay is most likely guilty, his lawyer got a subpoena. His lawyer got a subpoena and served it to Texas state prosecutor Ronnie Earle, saying there was misconduct by prosecutors. DeLay's lawyer said Earl refused the subpoena, and Earl said he voluntarily accepted it. The subpoena is a tactic to have Ronnie Earle drop the charges. It is also a dodge and a publicity prank to make Earl look dirty. Bottom line is DeLay's lawyers want Earl to answer questions about conversations he had with grand jurors. The motion filed last week by DeLay's lawyers say that Earl's staff, quote, unlawfully participated in grand jury deliberations and attempted to browbeat and coerce, end quote, the second grand jury that didn't indict DeLay. It also accuses Earl of inciting the foreman of that grand jury to violate grand jury secrecy by going public with information about the case. And they asked the foreman, Riley, this guy William Gibson, who said, he said, that's a bunch of there. That man did not talk to me, end quote.
Now he's talking about Ronnie Earle. And, of course, William Gibson is a former deputy sheriff. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not talking about some guy off the street here. What, I don't know what evidence DeLay's lawyer is trying to, hatch this plot, too. In other words, did he talk to somebody on the grand jury, and the grand jury told him that Ronnie, or is he just speculating that, you know, a Texas grand jury would never have indicted DeLay unless Ronnie Earl had, in some way, shape, or form, coerced him into doing so?
I think this is straight-out Rovian crap. I think what Tom DeLay and his lawyers are trying to do is avoid, you know, all they're trying to do is get some time, number one, and to slander, basically make Earl look dirty. These things aren't going to stick. The subpoena doesn't make a difference. If Earl's got the dirt, he's got the dirt, and maybe it'll stick, and DeLay will go down. But all this appearance is on the press. The sad thing is like, this is a guy that is cornered. He's a cornered Republican, and he's doing what Republicans do when they're cornered. They act confident, and they claim that they did nothing wrong, and they spit at Democrats. Now, he's been on TV and radio 20 times. Isn't that unbelievable? We can't get a Democrat on this show to come even and talk about the platforms of the Democratic Party at this point in time. Democrats can't seem to figure out how to utilize the press as well as the right does. Granted, the right has millions of dollars in think tanks behind them and an entire network of propaganda outlets that they can utilize, but it's just profound to me that this guy can speak directly into the minds of the Republican minions, and if they believe Tom DeLay is not guilty, they are lost.
Well,
they are,
I mean,
a lost cause.
I think he's done.
I hope so. Well, look, you know, Studs Terkel is coming up, so I'm looking forward to picking his brain. We got the Al Qaeda news as well, a second installment. Very disturbing stuff. Important. 27 past the hour, Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey,
it's Air America Radio, this morning's edition. Kayla, are we going to the market today or what? Oh, it's raining.
Yeah, it's raining.
Oh, yeah. We can't go. Ah, man, no fish. All right. A couple of weeks ago, the Washington Post reported that Al Qaeda had begun producing a Western-style newscast for the internet, complete with an anchor in a ski mask and a gun pointed at the camera. Well, our crack investigative squad here managed to get another advanced copy of the next broadcast. So here is the latest dispatch from Al Qaeda News.
From around the world, out of an undisclosed location, and from under a hood to hide our identity, this is Al-Qaeda News.
Good evening.
And by that we mean fear us!
I am Mohammed.
And I am Mahmoud.
Tonight's top story, the female reporter from New York Times, Judith Miller, has revealed who told her name of exposed CIA agent. Scooter Libby, you are Al-Qaeda feel-good story of the week.
American national security has been compromised. People should be pleased, but their brains are diseased by castrating women and gay sex. Death to America! Death to imperialism!
We have some breaking news from London. A bomb has gone off at undisclosed location at approximately 3:15. Tomorrow, give or take. Now in Hollywood news, here's Jerry with the Tinseltown update.
Party girl Paris Hilton has called off her engagement with fiancé Paris Latsis.
Oh boy, you're kidding. They look so happy.
The 24-year-old star of The Simple Life told reporters she just wasn't ready for marriage and didn't want to rush into it.
24? She should have 10 children by now. She's letting life pass by.
Thank you, Jerry. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yes, I just want to let my family know I'm alive and being treated well.
Thank you, Jerry. You will die soon. And finally, I can't read cue card. As producer, we cut to sports now.
No sports! Human interest!
Idiot.
Oh, yes. Now, a special feature. We close with human interest commentary from very special guests. Here are Few Minutes with Osama Bin Rooney.
You know what irritates me. American imperialism and the great citizen George Bush. But also airport baggage claim. My bag always lots one come out. Who gets first bag? No one! Then I am strip searched, then gunmen appear, and I must flee and hide in cave for 4 years.
That was a few minutes with Osama bin Laden. And that is all for Al Qaeda news. Remember, when news happens,
we caused it.
Bye-bye!
Yeah, and I'm not sure that's right.
All right, look, we're all going straight to hell.
Our next guest is a radio legend. He won a Pulitzer Prize for The Good War, an oral history of World War II. He chronicled the Depression through the memories of those who experienced it in his book, Hard Times. His new book is a collection of interviews he's done with musicians, singers, and composers over the past 50 years called And They All Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey. Good morning, Studs Terkel. Thank you for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here. This
new adventure.
Yes, sir.
Good morning.
To reach out to people who may say no to power.
Well, why don't we start with that, saying no to power? I mean, you've been around a long time. You've interviewed a lot of people. You are a populist in your approach to oral histories and literature. What is your reaction to this administration?
Well, I think deep, deep down, and of course the media plays a tremendous role in keeping us less free than we could be, than we presumably are. The non-questioning, immediately we have, quote-unquote, a wartime president.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, by the way, to the Democratic Party. That is a Democratic leadership. There is a Democratic caucus that I think is time they took over.
Yeah, it's time they do
because
something.
The Democratic Leadership Council has done a marvelous job of auto-castration. No, they have. They have absolutely... Example in point. I'll be very brief about this because I want to get to the book on music.
Yes.
That's also, by the way, dealing with a matter of freedom. But take the last campaign of Kerry and Bush. Kerry, at the beginning, said he was a young guy and he was lied to by the president, LBJ.
Yes.
Tonkin Bay came back furious. Later on, he's elected U.S. Senator and he's lied again by a president who says mass war production by Saddam Hussein proved indubitably untrue. And, of course, should keep going with that, so therefore he feels as furious a senator as he did when he was a young officer. But then they ask him, are you for or against the war? I'm for the war. It's just that it's foot wrong. Then and there, the election was over. There's no point further discussion. He declared him wartime president, and no matter what, and it's that advice he got from Joe Biden and from Hillary Clinton. And I'm talking now about this group called centrist, move toward the center. If ever there was something else being perverted, it's the American language.
Yes.
When you move to the center, it means you move to the right. That's an automatic phrase. You never say a right winger is moving toward the center. Someone who's leaning toward the left, a liberal, moving toward the right, is moving toward the center. Now, this is radio and not TV, but I'll try to act it out physically. Imagine then, imagine if our physical posture, our physical posture followed our political posture.
Yes.
But what is center and what is right and what is left? Now, I'm going to stand up right now. This will have to be a narration. I'm standing up, and I'm now leaning to my right this way.
Yeah.
Hunch, you're leaning to my right. This is the way normal people walk. And I say, you lean to the right. This means, of course, you are normal. How you doing, Charlie? Fine, says the other guy leaning to the right. How's the wife and kids? Fine. Just then, somebody walks by, and he's erect. He walks by, says, look at that guy. He's leaning to the left. You see, the guy's walking straight. And so the guy makes a slight turn the way they do,
yeah.
And the guy turns a little toward the left this way. Oh, my God, he's a friend of terrorists. You see? So what happens here, the guy's to the right, normal, to lean to the right. You lean a little further to the right, way back, you're practically fascist. But you're called ultra-conservative.
Right.
And that's what we do with the American language, is an assault. Now, we were assaulted in 9/11. That was an assault.
Yes, sir.
But there's another kind of assault to our intelligence and to our sense of decency. The perversion of language is part of it.
Propaganda.
So let's save the American language, the language of Tom Paine. He says, treason is not to be confused with reason. And so when you reason and you say something is wrong, it is not treasonous.
We're talking to Studs Terkel, author, radio broadcaster. His new book is And They All Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey.
I've talked myself to some of the people that you have in this book. I met Betty Carter when she was alive. I met John Hammond. The thing that struck me in this book is how much room you gave each subject to speak as an interviewer. You didn't pepper them with questions, which I guess is one way of doing things, but you gave them a tremendous amount of room. When did you come to the decision to let them talk?
I don't know. I was raised in a men's hotel. A working men's hotel. It wasn't a flop house. A working men's hotel, and there was the Depression, and guys around her, working men, and they always argued, always with debates and so on. I was accustomed to argument, debate, listening. Irony is, I'm mostly deaf, so I'm the listener who's deaf. But it's hearing Andrei Segovia, the great guitarist, 85 years old. He worships a guitar as though it were a woman. He is that classical guitar. Why did you choose that when the repertoire is so limited? And most of the stuff is his own transcriptions. When there's a piano, he says, "No, the guitar is Spain." And he plucks that little guitar. A hall of 5,000 people are listening. And then he says, one of his friends, a lecturer, was bawled out by a listener who said, "He spoke too softly. We had to listen." So the next time the lecturer spoke even more softly. That's what made them listen closer. So you listen.
Even
it's
more.
Listening and something quite marvelous about that. Some of these interviews took place 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Like Bob Dylan is 22 years old when he writes of the song "Hard Rain's Gonna Fall," one of his early songs that was powerful. And he says every one of those lines is a song. And there was one line that knocked me out. And the line was, "The executioner's face is always well hidden. And suddenly you think of the whole history. Sure, the hidden faces of axemen, of hangers.
Yes.
What about the executioners who are not even present? I refer to high officials, of course.
Bureaucratic executioners.
Need I name them?
Mm-hmm.
The executioners mm-hmm. of thousands of people, whether mm-hmm. they be Iraqi or American. Always well hidden. I got nothing to do with it.
Yep.
So that's a key line there.
We're talking to Studs Terkel, Pulitzer Prize winner, journalist, radio broadcaster, and author. His new book is titled "And They All Sang: Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey." Stay with us. We'll have more with Studs Terkel in just a minute. It's 44 past the hour on Morning's Edition, Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition.
It's just to wake you up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour, you're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
We're talking to Studs Terkel, author, radio broadcaster. His new book is "And They All Sang: Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey." Now, when you talk to some of these musicians in the '60s, specifically like Bob Dylan, like Janis Joplin, I've seen them interviewed. They can be sort of cryptic. When you sit down with them, do you find that people generally, once they sit down, want to reveal themselves? Did you have any problems at all that you can remember?
No. I asked her about Port Arthur, the town she comes from.
This is Janis?
Yeah, a lousy town. The smell of oil and a father, not a bad guy. But they wanted her to behave herself as others do. That is to be supine, not to question.
Mm-hmm.
But she questioned. She was full of vitality. She heard a Bessie Smith record that drove her crazy because she recognized a vitality in there that was in her. And yet when I caught her at this little abandoned ballroom years ago when young guys and women would go dancing, meet each other, get married. This is one of those abandoned ballrooms, mm-hmm. the Aragon. And the kids are all stoned. It's half, you can't see them. They're stoned. But she's not. Although she had, of course, comfort, southern comfort, mm-hmm. a horrible drink, you know.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
a sweet drink.
Yeah, it's flammable.
But
it's, yeah.
at the same time, she had a juiciness to her,
mm-hmm.
a juice of life in
oh,
her.
Oh, yeah.
And so you urge that out.
Oh, yeah.
You don't force it out. It's in conversation. Sometimes my own flaws are revealed. For example, I come with a tape recorder. I happen to be very inept mechanically. I can't drive a car. I can't ride a bike. And I can't operate a the tape machine, which I have. I press the wrong button sometimes by mistake. And the person, the so-called ordinary person, a word I dislike, but the person says, look, it's not moving, when it was unreal. I goofed. At that moment, that person feels more important than I do. That person feels I need him or her to help. And they do. And that's tremendous. It's not, I'm not from on high, Baba Wah 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 Walters.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not that at all. Or some 60 Minutes. It's just a guy, like I lost Catherine Graham. Not Catherine Graham. Martha Graham.
Yeah.
Much, much finer person. Martha Graham. I lost Michael Redgrave. I almost lost Bertrand Russell.
Yeah.
And then I'd have put my head in the oven. So you see, my being inept sometimes is my asset.
Right.
I understand.
We're talking to Studs Terkel, author, radio broadcaster. The new book is titled, And They All Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey. You know, I am so respectful and hungry to know some more about your insights into politics. If I can switch the subject one more time to go to a different topic. I mean, you've seen a lot of presidents. You've interviewed some, I'm sure. This president is horrendous. Without a doubt, who was the best president in your
recollection? Well, mine had to be Franklin D. Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. First, I was 19, the Depression, the New Deal, but basically, I'd say the worst by far is Bush, but it began. We have to begin with Ronald Reagan. It was Ronald Reagan who threw out the New Deal, basically. He began. A new figure came into being called the Reagan Democrat. A blue-collar guy and race, no doubt, was a tremendous factor. But he played upon the smaller angels in us. He, this young hack actor. By the way, there was a vote. Discovery Channel had that vote.
Yes.
4.5 million Americans. Who was the greatest American leader of all time? Who do you think it was?
It was Reagan, wasn't it?
Ronald Reagan.
Horrendous.
Forget about Lincoln. Forget about Franklin. Forget about Tom Paine. And so this is upside-down history.
What is that about the collective memory? Why is it so retarded at this point in time?
You see, collective memory. I say we are suffering right now from a national Alzheimer's disease.
Yes.
That is, there's no memory of yesterday. We know that. There's a new star tomorrow. I don't know who these new stars are today.
What do you attribute that to?
I'll begin tomorrow, but imagine how it is about something happened 70 years ago, the New Deal. Think of Social Security.
Yeah.
How many millions of older people are alive and breathing because of Social Security.
Well, you've talked to a lot of people, Mr. Terkel. What do you attribute that Alzheimer's to? What is causing that?
Well, I think day after day after day, the Cold War played a tremendous role.
Mm-hmm.
We never quite recovered from the Cold War. A tremendous role. They have the guy so-and-so. He's a red. Back in 1800, when Jefferson fought Adams, there was Alien Sedition Acts, and a guy who was fighting against the Alien Sedition Acts was called a Jacobin, who was a left-wing French revolutionary. Then there were the abolitionists, who were troublemakers, many of whom got killed. These are what I call the dissenting minority, the prophetic minority. And Elijah Lovejoy, an abolitionist, got killed by a mob slavery guy. Remember his name, few do. So there always has been this group called the prescient minority to me, and I value them.
Yes, sir.
They always have.
Absolutely.
Studs Terkel, it was great talking to you. I wish you greatest luck with the book, and you know, you've had an amazing career, and I certainly feel it was a tremendous privilege to be in your presence today.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Thank you both very much.
We'll be broadcasting live from Restaurant Florent in New York's Meatpacking District this Friday, folks. We'll have New York City Democratic mayoral candidate Fernando Ferrer will be with us if you get there early. He's coming down pretty early, Riley. I think he's planning on coming by like around 6 o'clock, 6:15.
Yeah.
He's a very busy man now running for mayor. If you have, I think the last time he was on, we fielded some questions from people in the audience. So if you'd like to maybe ask Freddie Ferrer a question, you might want to get there early. That's Restaurant for Laurent. It's down on Ganzevoort Street in the Meatpacking District this Friday morning. You can always email Morning Sedition. It's sedition@airamericaradio.com. In the upcoming hour here, oddly enough, I'm not oddly enough. Well, I don't have to be ashamed of my fixation on cooking and food, do I? I do not. Mark Bittman, journalist turned food writer, spent 6 years traveling around the world to write the best recipes in the world, more than 1,000 international dishes to cook at home. I didn't even bring the book back in. It was given to me by our people here, and I was going to bring it out. So I might want to have the book if I'm going to talk to this guy. And then I'm like, no, someone might take my book, and I left it at my house.
I would have.
Yeah, you would have. You know, you're turning into a little cooker. You know, there. Yeah, and I appreciate, like, you ask me questions, but I'm not that. I'm just good. I have a good sense of it. I'm no genius at cooking.
I'm embarrassed though. My questions are normally very embarrassing.
That's all right. This guy Bittman apparently wrote another book on just the basics of cooking, so he might be a good guy to talk to. And I don't want people to go like, oh no, they're just going to have a guy wrote a cookbook on.
Well, he also wrote an article about the crock pot and cooking with a crock. Pot, which is, you know, near and dear to my heart, Mark.
Yeah, well, we both crock. It's especially in the winter, we're going to be doing some crocking.
That's crock time.
We didn't have a crock off last year. We talked about crocking it, and we didn't. And we're going to have a crock off.
I'm going to crock a whole chicken and a whole corned beef here in the studio one of these days.
I'm going to kick your crock with my crock. Well, look, and also we have other things to talk about. We have Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, in deep poop. We got Scooter Libby. He's in deep poop, as well as everybody in the inner circle in the administration is in deep poop. And also, we're going to talk about the results of Katrina. And we had a window there, folks. Poverty was at the top of the docket for discussion. And now we're letting them steal that flame away from us. We'll talk about that in a second. It's 57 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Political family is at war with itself inside the White House. My sense is it's Andy Card, the chief of staff, and his people against Karl Rove, the brain.
Right.
And that runs through a whole lot of things, whether it's Harriet Myers or Katrina, but it all starts with Iraq and some submerged but now emerging divisions within the administration over why we went into that war, how we went into that war, and what was done to sell it. There are people out for Karl Rove inside that White House, which makes his situation even more perilous.
That was Howard Fineman on NBC. He's the chief political correspondent, and he was on Harbaugh with Chris Matthews with a bongo player, which really surprised a lot of people. But he was talking about, by the way, it's 7 past the hour if you're just tuning in. Good morning. Welcome aboard. It's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Yeah, Howard Fineman was talking about the scandals that are pervading the GOP at this point in time, but specifically the scandal involving the leak of Valerie Plame's name to the media by who knows who and how many are involved and what is going on. Man, it's getting crazy. But the idea that there's infighting within the White House between Chief of Staff Andrew Card and also Chief of Staff Karl Rove, his exact title is Deputy Chief of Staff. There you go. Because, I mean, you got to figure there's got to be some always been bickering between those two in the sense that if Andrew Card is the Chief of Staff and Karl Rove is the Executive Chief of Staff, yet he is running the world or Deputy Chief of Staff, there has to be tension between these two. And now it's coming to head because I imagine, Riley, and correct me if I'm wrong, that whatever is left of whoever may not be as guilty as the other guy within the neocon death cult are going to try to protect their interests and the interests of the group that they're insulating themselves.
Well, the one thing that's missing out of this entire equation is the one person that usually kept these neocons away from each other's throat. Guess who that might be?
Dick Cheney.
There you go. Right. Pop Cheney was the one that took care of all the adolescents, the Karl Roves, the Cards, all of these different people, and Cheney hasn't been seen much lately.
Well, that's either because he's hooked up to a machine that's keeping him alive, or because, as there are some ruminations, that the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg are both working on stories right now that point to Dick Cheney as the target of Fitzgerald's entire investigation. Now, that doesn't mean anyone else is getting off the hook. A lot of indictments can come down. down. But if he's at the top of the list, that would have some implications about why there is no regulator in terms of keeping the neocon death cult from eating its own. Now, talking about Dick Cheney, his chief of staff, Scooter Libby, in two appearances before the federal grand jury investigating the leak of covert CIA operatives Valerie Plame's name, Scooter Libby did not disclose a crucial conversation that he had with New York Times reporter Judith Miller in June 2003. That's 3 weeks before the Joe Wilson op-ed that said that the LOK claims were BS, and another 3 days or 5 days after that before Robert Novak actually leaked Joe Wilson's wife Valerie Plame's name. So what this means is that these new notebooks that were revealed of Judith Miller's that were just found at the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, and she's been to see the grand jury to testify twice. She's going back today. She was there yesterday, right?
Yep.
That what they've revealed is that these two were talking way before it was assumed, and obviously the Scooter Libby is guilty of some obstruction of justice for not coming up with this information before, and it still goes along the lines of either a criminal conspiracy or else he's really going after Dick Cheney, but this thing continues to unfold.
Well, yeah, it continues to unfold, and here's the problem the administration has. Each and every one of these people have said that their concerns, regardless of course, that none of them have admitted any wrongdoing, but that their concerns about what Joe Wilson had to say on July 6, 2003, started on July 6, 2003. We now know from the sequence of events that now is coming to light that at least on June 23rd, 2003, because believe me, Fitzgerald wouldn't be asking Judith Miller to come back if the substance of her conversation with Scooter Libby was about welfare reform or Social Security or the estate tax. The reason why they're coming back, why she's coming back, the reason why Rove has testified four different times is because Fitzgerald believes, and I think the grand jury well believes, that these folks were talking to reporters trying to undercut Joe Wilson, who was also talking to reporters at that time.
Well, this is interesting because, you know, up until this point, Riley, and I think you might have just touched on this, is that we have been only focusing on post Robert Novak.
Yep.
You know, we have only been focusing on, there's the Joe Wilson's piece in the New York Times. Bam. 5 days later, there's Novak's piece and everything that happened after that. And, you know, a couple of days before in leading up to these leaks. But now we're talking about weeks before.
Yeah.
So, and weeks before can really, you know, have other implications. And if Dick Cheney's the guy that, you know, was sitting there, because it's been pretty much assumed that Dick Cheney was the guy that was operating through Valerie Plame or through the CIA to get Joe Wilson to go.
Well, yeah, and that's the smoking gun that may implicate Dick Cheney in this. He had the most to lose. Joe Wilson's critical report, if the media began to spread the story that this was Dick Cheney's handpicked guy and he came back with information that completely blew apart the rationale for going into Iraq, that puts Cheney on the spot. So how does he deal with it? He has to undercut Joe Wilson. And the easiest way to do that is say, I didn't have anything to do with sending him over to Niger. That was an internal decision and probably done by his wife.
I'll tell you, I know what Dick Cheney's going to do just to show everybody he's going to die. All right, look, there are more problems. We not more problems for us. It's kind of exciting. I'll just say this, you know, in relation to this this federal grand jury investigation, I hope it is as bad as we've been assuming it's going to be. I hope that these indictments come down. I really do. These guys are criminals. Many are guilty of treason, at the very least perjury. They are guilty of complicity of the deaths of a couple of thousand American soldiers, the injuring of thousands of others because they were sent to war based on a lie. They cajoled the American people. They frightened the American people and continue to do that to get what they want. These guys are criminals. The neocon death cult, the Bush crime family, as Mike Malloy likes to call them, are criminals, and I hope to God that this is enough to at least raise the awareness of that to some of the monkeys out there that still might be on the fence. And when I say monkeys, I mean dumb people that can't seem to understand that what they're believing in is right. You know what? That's saying a bad thing about monkeys. Why don't I just say dumb people who don't understand that they're being misled by a bunch of criminals? Also, criminal number, I guess, 7 or 8, I don't know, number 2, whatever you want to call them, documents show that Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist earned tens of thousands of dollars from stocks in HCA, his family-founded hospital chain. The stocks were largely controlled by his brother, and the stocks were outside the blind trusts he created to avoid a conflict of interest. Remember, this guy's been saying over and over again that he could own HCA shares and still vote on health care legislation without a conflict because he had placed his stock in blind trust. Well, that's starting to come under investigation a little more succinctly, I guess would be the word, that his brother was overseeing a lot of this money. Like, he's not going to talk to his brother?
Well, I mean, when is a blind trust not a blind trust? When your brother is in charge of the blind trust. And remember that the blind trust here is outside the purview of the blind trust that he established when he rose to the leadership of the Senate. This was a blind trust in the state of Tennessee, and he knew about the transactions. He knew about the directions that aspect of his company, of his family business, was involved in. And that's where the conflict of interest is. He swore he wouldn't have to worry. No one have to worry about me. It's in a blind trust. I won't know what's going on. Obviously, he did.
He's dirty. They're all dirty. Yeah, just like DeLay. What a desperate thing it was. He shows you. DeLay is definitely guilty because his lawyer got a subpoena and served it to the Texas State Prosecutor, Ronnie Earle, who is raising the indictments against him. It's such a sleazy little tactic to try and smear somebody who's obviously got the goods on him. We'll get into that a little later. We got our Angus McFarker, our international correspondent, is on the line, and also coming up, we want to talk a little bit about how on an issues level, the liberals and the Democrats and some progressives in terms of the cultural dialogue are losing some traction around the issue of poverty that was revealed so graphically after Katrina. It's 15 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Lawton Smalls, Morning Sedition's Planet Bush Bureau Chief. You know why I'm praying for you? Because you're listening to Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Twenty past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Hey, you know what? Restaurant Florent, New York's Meatpacking District, Friday morning, Gansevoort Street. Be there. We'll be there. Me and Pops Riley. You can touch him.
No.
All right. Fernando Ferrer will be there. You can touch him. You'll at least shake his hand. He likes to do that, right?
Yeah.
That's what they do.
He's running for something.
Yeah. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been meeting with new leaders of Kyrgyzstan, where the U.S. has reached agreement on long-term rights to maintain an airbase there for servicing military aircraft on missions to Afghanistan. For more on the story live from Kyrgyzstan, here is Morning Sedition's foreign correspondent, Angus McFarker. What are the long-term implications of this agreement, Angus?
Well, Mark, Condoleezza Rice has got into a wee barney, a total bampot, a dunderhide, and it was like she was blooded and just said, "Hold your waist, eat the bread." Well, this prompted the Kyrgyzstani officials to say, "Look, we cannae be arsed. Dinna fass yourself. I'll give a Glasgow kiss to that wee hacket gook." It was just as we suspected, Mark.
Right. Yeah. That's what I thought, Angus.
And to further complicate matters, the American hide the bad didn't want to be thought of as a hangout, harping about. So she shoots back that the Kyrgyz are a lot of manking, minging, bastard gadgets. You might imagine that left everyone feeling a bit peely wally, Mark.
Oh, yeah, Angus. I still have a couple of questions about this.
I'm happy to explain anything I can, Mark.
Oh, okay.
I'm a professional.
Well, all right.
Hey, what are you want, Nazi?
Excuse me. I need to see your press credentials.
Excuse me, son.
Oh, what's happening?
Don't you see I'm doing a radio broadcast here? I don't come around interrupting your part of me job, wanker?
Oh, no.
This is a restricted area. I will need to see your credentials, please.
Oh, I'm going to stick my fist in your restricted area, you cocky bastard. Bastard. So, Mark.
Yeah.
So, Mark.
Yes.
This is another ploy, by the Bush administration to achieve hegemony in a part of the world, where their foreign policy has repeatedly failed.
All right.
They neglected Afghanistan to fight an unwinnable war in Iraq,
right?
And now, the Bush administration must scramble to and make deals to compensate for their woeful short sightedness. Right. Got it? Wanker! Wanker!
All right, okay. All right. Thank you, Angus. Thank
okay,
you.
Don't
thank
you.
All
right. Come here, bastard! Oi! Oi!
Oh, boy. Yeah, okay. You know, Angus is he's a good correspondent, sometimes difficult to understand,
right?
And always seems to have some problem. Kyrgyzstan, right?
Kyrgyzstan. Yes.
You know, I'm sorry.
She visited all the stands this
she
week.
It was a big stands tour, from what I understand. All right, let's get into it from what I understand. All right, Chris, don't even look at me like that. Like, I don't want the nice try face, funny boy. I don't want the nice try funny boy face.
That was cute. I like it.
Oh, cute. That's all right. Try and make up for it. Let's go to the market anyways, even if it's raining and it's
just stand
and
there.
And there's just a guy selling one apple. All right. There was and is, right now, a window into extreme poverty in this country through the results of Katrina. I mean, no one has ever seen it like that. There was a window into complacency and complete inefficiency on behalf of this government. It was all over the news, and leverage was ripe for the taking by Democrats. All the issues were right there, right out in the open like a wound. Health care, housing, race, jobs. This president was actually talking about them, or at least mentioning them. We had a shot to reframe and follow up and draw attention to some solutions. And I think we fizzled a little bit, Riley. Why? Why are they able to hijack it? As John Kerry pointed out shortly after the hurricane, the neocon death cult and its minions are using the disaster to reinvent disaster relief through enforced privatizations, and they are going to pay for it all on the back of the people it affected the most. Poor people.
Well, yeah, they're going to cut Medicare. They're talking about cutting food stamps. But see, there's an element in all this that even the Democrats are afraid to talk about. And it's something that the Bush administration has done so well, I am stunned, actually, that people will talk about trying to reframe this without talking about Iraq.
Right.
All that, $300 billion has gone to Iraq.
Right.
Now, if we had that $300 billion, then Democrats might have some legs to say, well, we could spend $200 billion of it trying to rebuild New Orleans and the other areas that have been devastated by the hurricanes. But the fact is, because there's no money, the conservatives then say, well, we have to cut something.
Yeah, but it's like, but what I don't understand is they continue to support these tax cuts for rich people. And in a time of war, in a time of disaster, they still give rich people, the really wealthy, these tax cuts. Where, why can't these wealthier people, these wealthier families, understand that part of their civic duty is to give a little back so we can manage some of this stuff? Outside of the irresponsibility of the neocon death cult, blowing all this money in a failed venture in Iraq that was based on a lie to begin with, I just don't understand. I mean, apparently even Clinton raised taxes on upper-income families, and the economy boomed for a little while.
Well, the economy was not hurt by it, but this administration came into office on the promise of making sure that rich people got richer, and that they got richer through American tax policy, not through any work that they did.
Well, I'll tell you what frightens me about this is they don't govern. These guys do politics. We've discussed that. Negligence of governing properly means, you know, equals misspent funds, which go into the pockets of people they want the money to go in the pockets to. It's pork, right?
Well, it's pork, but see, the important thing is that the Democrats missed an opportunity
here. Yes, absolutely.
And the Republicans jumped on an opportunity here.
But it just frightens me that they figure out a way to make money through they're opportunistic, like negligence in governing equals disaster, which we have, and now they're going to profit off the disaster by subcontracting, by repealing Bacon-Davis and not allowing the workers to be paid the minimum wage, by taking up, by pulling back the affirmative action laws, by possibly they could have employed even a lot of people within the city to help rebuild the city, but they're trying to figure out ways around that to capitalize on this thing.
Well, yeah, because the conservatives use every situation at their disposal to push their agenda, and that's something that the Democrats have not yet learned how to do. For the conservatives, this is a windfall. This is something, manna from heaven.
Right.
It allows them to say, well, look, all of these programs didn't work. Look how poor the people were anyway. Let's get rid of some more programs to pay.
But and not only that, though, on a free market level, on the level of privatization, on the level of actually exploiting the situation more for financial gain, not just policy gain, these guys, like John Kerry pointed out early on, he said this is going to become some sort of disaster free market experiment, not unlike Iraq. These guys immediately started saying, well, look, let's see if we can do all this through the private sector. Let's see if we can use the faith-based initiatives to take care of these people. Let's actually see if this policy we've enacted not only works, but we can make a fortune off of this damn hurricane.
Well, yeah, and the spigot of campaign contributions from the rich that benefit by these policies will continue.
Well, you know what? In just a few minutes, we're going to talk to Mark Bittman about food. How do you like that?
Yeah.
I like food. 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
There you go. 34 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I was wondering why we're actually hearing lyrics, and of course, it's the cleverness of Chris Lopresto on
there
the board to sort of tie things together with a little food Beatles. Yeah, isn't it? That's who this is. Yeah. Of course it is. From the White Album, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
That's right. Talk about dream jobs, my friends. Our next guest traveled the globe in search of the best dishes in the world. He put the results in his new cookbook, The Best Recipes in the World, more than 1,000 international dishes to cook at home. He also writes the Minimalist Weekly column in the New York Times. Please welcome to Morning's Edition, Mark Bittman. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Mark.
I'll tell you, man, I saw that book on our booker's desk, and I'm like, whoa, what's that? Because I'm a freak. I love to cook. And I took it home, and I'd even been bringing it back in. And I tell you, it's a great book. I've already made like 3 or 4 of the recipes in just a week, smaller recipes. But you traveled to 44 countries to collect recipes for the book. And you don't, you know, you're not svelte, but you're not fat. You did all right.
I am svelte.
But so tell me, where'd you go? And I noticed that you did sort of level off on a few regions that have the most of the recipes are from.
Yeah, you know, without insulting any place, if you go to a country and you wind up coming back with 3 or 4 recipes, it's kind of a waste of time. So yeah. I went to the culinary hotspots. I spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia, uh-huh. India, the Middle East, and Europe, and yeah. Mexico. I mean, those were sort of the primary things.
And so, Russia, too, I noticed. There's a few recipes from Russia.
Yeah, I was in Eastern Europe. You know, it was...
It's kind of hard, Eastern Europe.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't great. You know, I had to sort of cut my losses. And after September 11th, it got hard to travel. Uh-huh. So I did a little less traveling than I would have liked to have done. But... you know, the amazing thing about the United States is that we have restaurants from all over the world, obviously. We have ingredients from all over the world. So what was terrific was that I'd travel and I'd come back and was really able to duplicate this stuff at home. That's what the book is about. It's not so much about traveling. It's about home cooking the way the rest of the world does home cooking.
Yeah, and also it was very helpful. And by the way, you do look svelte. I'm sorry, I didn't want to hurt anyone's feelings.
I'm crying. I noticed.
Like,
I was among friends.
He seems a little distracted. I'm like, what the hell did I just say? I just did what my mother does to me. To him. See, it's a displacement thing. It's called moving the Jewish buck next to you. So what was interesting to me in the book is that you talk about how you can stock your cabinet for each type of cuisine, and it's fairly minimal. The supplies you need to cook basic food from all these different regions you're talking about is minimal.
Well, you know, a friend of mine says there's really only 9 recipes in the world. And while it's a little more complicated than that, there are really only a few cooking techniques. If you think about it, there's, you know, cooking in water, cooking in oil, stir-frying, broiling, grilling, etc. It's not that many.
And microwaving, of course.
Well, oh, yeah. Most important. What really changes is the sort of flavor profile from one place to another. But if you just shift... you know, you shift cilantro for parsley, you shift fish sauce for soy sauce, for vinegar, for olive oil. You shift these sort of flavors, you change the way you're eating. And a lot of the basic flavors of different cuisines are pantry items. I mean, some are fresh. Cilantro, obviously, you can't keep. But vinegar, soy sauce, fish sauce, olive oil, parmesan, these are things that keep forever.
You know what's hilarious is, like, you're basically saying that the difference between one region of the world and another is the different salty liquid.
Well, that's part of it. Or the different herb, the different level of acidity. I mean, when you think about it, these are different components that you're putting in. I mean,
Absolutely. It
is pretty straightforward. I mean, everybody that can afford to in the world eats meat. So what do you do to the meat that you're eating, you know, or the fish that you're eating, the vegetable you're eating?
I don't eat meat anymore.
Well,
but I eat fish, and I eat everything else.
Yeah. Well, fish, I think, are living creatures.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, I don't need land meat.
Okay. Now, one of the things I find fascinating about this is that for a lot of people, when you start talking about different kinds of spices, you know, pantry items, they think you have to go to a specialty store to get them. Do you?
Well, this is what's changed incredibly in the last 15, 20 years. I mean, I've been cooking for about 30 years, and I used to live in New Haven. And I'd have to drive all over, like you say, to find soy sauce, even olive oil, Parmesan. You'd have to drive all over the place. Now, the exception, ironically, is New York. But now, good supermarkets all over the country have everything.
Yeah.
I mean, you can find Thai ingredients, Indonesian ingredients, anything, Mexican ingredients. Yep. In New York, the supermarkets don't carry through, but you have other stores in New York that they carry.
Sure. Mark, I just wanted to tell you, let me tell the people who we're talking to again. Mark Bittman, the book is The Best Recipes in the World. I just want to say it's not a living thing reason that I don't eat meat, land meat. It's because I think it's dirty. But
trafe, is that the word?
No, not trafe. Just like I don't know. You read about the meatpacking industry, it disturbs me. But it's interesting in my neighborhood in Queens, because I just had this problem yesterday. I can go to an Egyptian market and I can get 90 different types of lentil. All right, but I could not find bonito flakes anywhere.
Right,
which are fish flakes used in Japanese cooking. I'm about to make the miso marinade from your book for fish, it looks like a very simple
awesome.
And great recipe.
Yeah. Incredible stuff.
I made the beet caviar last week, which
very
I thought
nice.
Was very nice.
That's
I'm
very
a big
nice.
Beet fan. I made your miso soup recipe yesterday, which I thought was very
you
good.
You obviously have some miso in the refrigerator.
I definitely have some miso in the refrigerator that I use. I think I use too much. I don't know. That's really a preference thing, isn't it, the amount of miso. What's your favorite recipe in the book out of all the thousand recipes?
Oh, my
recipes?
God. You know, come on.
Which one do you make the most? Just tell me which
you
one you
what?
Like.
You know which one I
to.
Make the roast? And I think you might have it there because you were talking about this before we started, is this shrimp and garlic.
Yeah.
And garlic. So shrimp, olive oil, garlic.
That's it.
Sometimes with cumin and paprika, sometimes not. To me, that's
cumin
like
and paprika, that would
the
be the difference between India and Italy.
I consider cumin and paprika sort of Spanish. So, but
okay,
yeah.
Cumin and paprika.
But you're on the right track.
Right,
you're on
right.
the right track.
That's right. Paprika is not Indian. It could be cumin, coriander, and maybe some ginger.
There, some yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, what? Go ahead.
Well, no, there was a recipe that I'm looking at here where you substituted shrimp for crab. Do you substitute a lot in some of these recipes? Is it easier, perhaps, to use certain dishes because they're more available in a particular area?
Well, you know, crab is expensive. Crab is hard to find. Shrimp is right there, and you've got shellfish. I mean, here's the thing. If you look at the tradition of cooking, it wasn't that specific. It was, what did we take out of the water today, or what did we grow this year, and how can we make it taste good? It wasn't, I can't cook this recipe because I only have cauliflower. You know, it was, okay, we have cauliflower, but we still have our olive oil, we still have our anchovies, we still have our garlic, so although we're traditionally doing this with broccoli, today we're doing it with cauliflower.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not, it's not that big a deal. Sometimes I think my recipes freak people out because they give you so many options that you say, oh, well, I don't know exactly what to do. But I feel like being too specific makes things more difficult.
Yeah, you want to give people a way to improvise. You know,
I want to give them a range of choices.
Sure. It's interesting because the guys over at the Marino & Sons Fish Market across the street from me, no matter what I buy there, I'm like, well, how do I cook
olive
it?
Olive oil, lemon, garlic.
That's it, right. They just go olive oil, a little right wine, garlic, parsley. You're all set. That's it.
You know, they're not wrong. They're not
That's
wrong.
Right. So what surprised you about, like, in your investigations, I'm sure you knew a lot going in, these different countries, what was the most surprising thing you found in one of these countries where you're like, either like, wow, this is really different than I anticipated, or this is really good, or wow, who would have known you put these two things together and it would taste like that?
You know, the surprise is, I did know going in what I was going to find, or largely what I was going to find. The surprises were more, sometimes I expected cuisines to be deeper than they really were. And
on a philosophical level?
No, but I mean that there'd be more depth than you'd see in the United States. Like in Japan, I thought, I'm going to really see stuff you don't see here.
Oh, like weird stuff.
Yeah. Not necessarily weird, but that's
a judgment.
People cooking at home would do different things than we see here.
Right.
And I didn't. And after 5 or 6 days, I felt like, you know, and I'm not saying, I love Japanese cooking, but after 5 or 6 days, I felt like, I'm not finding anything new here.
I just tried to picture what that looks like where you walk into a kitchen and there's just someone with a fish, like, smacking it on the counter, throwing it into the air and, you know, winging it in a pot.
I just thought, I don't know, there might be some different flavor profiles or different ways of using things, and I really didn't see that. What surprised me, you know, on the other side of the coin, I went to Scandinavia. I spent a couple of weeks in Scandinavia, and I thought the food was great, and it wasn't what I expected at all. In fact, it was very much like Japanese food in that it was simple, extremely fresh, really clean flavors, and I liked that a lot.
A lot of fish.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I got to assume that because you traveled the world to get these recipes, you went to places that aren't exactly as affluent as the United States. And the reason why I'm asking that is because there's a feeling, I think, that many people of moderate means in this country generally go to, or even poor people, go to fast food places because they don't think they can afford to make things at home. How did your, I mean, are your recipes expensive to put together for an average family?
That's like the best question anyone's asked me about this book so far. I mean, the short answer is no, they're not. The long answer is, you're right. I went around the world and I looked at what normal people cooked. And, you know, I was thinking this morning. I'm working on this dish called soca, which is, it's from southern France. It's basically chickpea flour and water made into a paste and roasted in an oven until it's browned, like a thin pizza, but the only three ingredients, chickpea, flour, water, and a ton of black pepper. I was thinking, this costs 30 cents to make this thing. And it is so good that I've been eating it twice a day for 4 days. I just can't stop it. And that's sort of not atypical of what people are. I mean, in some ways, there's sort of this level of affluence you have to get to before you can afford fast food, because home-cooked food is cheaper than fast food.
Fast food, yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
Fast food is just a total waste of money, whereas
home-cooked
food is what you, and bad for
yeah,
you. Home-cooked food is what you do when you want to spend your money on food and get the most for your money.
It's also a time thing. I'll tell you, you know, I prefer cooked food, home-cooked food over any food, even high-end restaurants. I'd rather cook myself. I know exactly what I'm getting. If I screw it up, I can start over. But it's a time thing. You know, cooking takes time. It takes prep time, and that's it. You know, you got to love that.
Well, it's true, and, you know, I'm entirely in agreement with you, but eating out takes time also. So if you have the hour and a half it takes to go out and eat out, you probably have the hour and a half it takes to cook for 45 minutes, eat for 20 minutes, and clean up.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I'm gonna come back at you with the, you know what the saddest part about cooking at home and the difference between cooking at home and eating out is that the sort of unfolding of the food when you eat out has a certain pace to it. Because I can spend 2 hours cooking something, and literally in three minutes, it's gone.
It's gone.
Oh, my God.
I know.
I mean, it's worth it because I love the process of cooking. I find it to be a zen activity, and I lose myself in it. And I've already enjoyed some of the zen of a couple of the recipes in the book. Do we have any pressing questions from the cooks in the booth before Mark Bittman leaves?
I'm a huge crockpot cooker, but I feel like there's still a lot more I could get out of the crock that I haven't gotten into. And I want to know if any general crockpot tips that are things that, you know, the average guy crockpot user wouldn't know.
So you get up at like 4 a.m, throw the stuff in the crockpot, come in here, and then go home and eat it.
Yeah, well, no, oftentimes I'll throw it in before I go to bed, and then it's ready when I wake up. You know, or I'll prepare it in the crock, put it in the fridge when I go to bed, and then when I wake up before I leave for work, I turn it on.
It's very together.
And then,
we like to call it OCD. Yeah. But together is certainly another way of looking at it.
I'm gonna do it together.
Couple things. I did a story about crockpots for the Times a couple years ago.
I had
a lot of fun.
I thought that thing was in my fridge for about a month.
A lot of fun. Two things. One is the crockpot for making chicken stock. It's unbelievable. You take the stuff, you throw it in, you turn it on. It doesn't even matter when you turn it off. It's so good. The other is basically anything that you are going to braise or stew, you can do in the crockpot. What it's not good at is things that have to be timed precisely. So you might think it was really good for beans or grains or, you know, whole grain, stuff like that. It's not, because those are things you want to stop cooking at a certain point.
Right.
But if it's like something you want to get as tender as you possibly can or extract as much flavor as you possibly can, that's the thing to do. I mean,
we're going to have you back, man.
Yeah.
Because we got to go, and I think we'd have more questions. Do you want to hang out for one more? What's your question, Chris? And we'll take him over the break for a minute.
Give me one good recipe with okra, or how do you
I hate this
it?
One good recipe.
Well, one good recipe with what?
Okra.
Okay, well,
okra.
let's think about it. And
I can
back.
Do it.
Okay, let's think about it. We're going to take a couple minutes. We got the okra recipe on the other side of this. We're talking to Mark Bittman. The book is The Best Recipes in the World. Stay with us. We're going to run Future Mark, too. I think he's back on the line, or that's what I meant to say. Oh boy. 47 Fast Air America Radio.
Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
All right, it's 52 past the hour. Mark Maron, it's Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. We're coming in for landing here. We're talking to Mark Bittman. His book, The Best Recipes in the World. There's like 1,000 recipes in there. We're having a great conversation. Kalo, the Costco ho, has asked, and I think this is in relation to the fact that we went to the green market last week, and I bought a big bag of okra, and of course, Chris was like, I don't know.
What's okra?
Slimy. Ew.
He's never had it before.
I didn't know what it was, and I was almost lynched for not knowing. Like, people were like, what? Who doesn't know about okra? I'm like, uh-oh. I was scared.
It's almost so, like a cactus pod.
If you don't like it, I mean, if you don't know it, then you might just steam it because then you might like it. But a lot of people don't like it because it's slimy. So there's a couple ways of dealing with that. Okay. One is you do what they do in the South, which is cut it up, dip it in cornmeal, and deep fry it. Yeah, which is great.
Is that with egg or no egg? Just dip it right in the cornmeal?
Just cornmeal, okay. Yeah. And then the other is cut into slivers, and you can roast it with olive oil or, you know, olive oil, chilies, garlic. And just keep roasting at pretty high heat, 400 or so, tossing it now and then until it kind of dries out and gets crisp. And that is really great stuff.
And if you steam it, though, like I found that it's not as slimy as if you cut it up and use it in a saute or a stew.
The thing is, if you like the sliminess, it's not a problem. But so many people are turned off by it. They just look at it and those seeds are coming out and they're...
Yeah, I like it. I thought it was
I've never been a big okra fan.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where I got accustomed to the taste. So what should I make tonight?
You should make that miso marinated fish. You know, miso, I think, is like one of the coming ingredients because it takes a year and a half to make good miso. So yeah. You're talking about something that's really the equivalent of Parmesan cheese when it comes to taking something that has almost no flavor, soybeans, and turning it into something that's like a powerhouse of flavor.
Oh, yeah, it's unbelievable.
It's great stuff.
Now, I got to ask you this one question because it's perplexed me ever since I traveled to Brazil some years ago. Here in the States, when people cook collard greens, they got to put some kind of grease in it. It's got to be pork or turkey wings or whatever.
Oh.
You go to Brazil and they cook collard greens. They boil them. They don't put any kind of grease to mitigate the taste. And I found them to taste wonderful in Brazil. Why is it that you know, greaseless collard greens seem unable to catch on here?
Well, I think there's a little more greaseless collard greens than there used to be here. But what I like to do with, I mean, I like steamed collard greens, and they're good. And you know, you need salt, and you need olive,
hot
you
sauce.
Need olive oil, hot sauce, lime juice, lemon juice. You need something because they're so muddy tasting. You know, you got to cut through.
Do
that.
They get bitter sometimes?
Well, they can get.
They can.
Bitter, yeah.
All right,
but when the other thing is, chop them up and cook them really fast in hot oil, no water at all. With chilies and garlic, and that's really good.
I got to do that because I just made something that tastes a little bitter, but we got to move on. Mark Bittman, the best recipes in the world. It was great talking to you. We're going to have you back. We'll have the whole show about crock-pot cooking.
All right, fine. And now I get to sit around and listen to the funny part.
Yeah, that's right. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. First Lady Laura Bush has said the criticism of Supreme Court nominee Harriet Myers may stem from sexism. Laura Bush said, quote, the president isn't showing any favoritism for Myers just because she happens to be his second wife. Mrs. Bush also says Myers was a role model for young women. So, girls, if you want to get ahead, find the drunkest frat boy in the room and then defend every horrible thing he does until he becomes president.
Call him the most brilliant man you ever met.
Exactly. Speculation ran rampant as Vice President Dick Cheney was conspicuously absent from a big conservative shindig. Unconfirmed reports indicate Cheney was rolling around in a big pile of money and lost track of time. Pundits cautioned against making too much out of Cheney's absence, noting that the president is often absent himself, even when he's there. Cheney's aide said his absence was due to a scheduling conflict. They actually meant Cheney was rescheduling a conflict, either in Syria or possibly North Korea. Iraq's election commission said that Saddam Hussein will be allowed to vote in Saturday's election. Officials say that if Saddam needs to show some identification at the polls, he can unfurl an 80-foot banner of himself from 1985. Sources close to Saddam say he'll vote for whichever candidate opposes the death penalty. Heck, I thought, all right, here we go. Phrase of the day, folks, just drop this into conversation. What do you know? The value of Dick Cheney's Halliburton stock options rose 3,281% in the last year. Wake up, sheeple. The man is saving up for a new body, and he's thinking about taking yours. Mark Bittman, thank you. Mark Riley, what do we got tomorrow?
Tomorrow we got Chris Mooney on the Republican War on Science. Plus, we've got another installment of Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
Ah, yes.
So now we have to go out in the rain and the cold and the wind and whatever else is going on here in New York City.
Sounds exciting.
I hope it's better where you are. Mark Bittman, again, thanks a lot.
It's been great to be here, guys. Thanks
good show, buddy.
Good show. We'll see you tomorrow right here on Air America Radio.